Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was it like to live in Berlin during the years when the Third Reich was ravaging Europe and ordering the torture, enslavement, and execution of many of its own citizens with impunity? While much has been published about the deprivations in the countries Hitler invaded and occupied, the world is less familiar with the stories of wartime life in the city that was the epicenter of his quest for world domination. Roger Morehouse is an author and historian of modern German history. He pored through diaries, news accounts, interviews, and even SS mood reports to understand the realities of life in the city during World War II. He brings them all together in his new book, Berlin at War. Roger, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
We should start by saying that Berlin would not seem an obvious choice as the capital of the Third Reich. Culturally, it was not a great fit with Nazi ideology. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's very true, actually. And Berlin's sort of political and social traditions were in many ways very alien to Nazi ideology. Nazism, of course, was originally a sort of very South German phenomenon, which gained a lot of political support in the north of Germany. But Berlin, of course, being in the north, had very different traditions. I mean, it wasn't a city in which the Nazis had no support. They had gained generally about a third of the vote up until 1933. So it certainly had a proportion of Nazi supporters, but it had a lot of other traditions which were very strong. It had a very, very strong communist and socialist tradition, and it was a very traditionally a bastion of Jewish settlement as well. So there are two very profound factors that argued against Nazi ideology in the city.
Was that something that Berliners took as a source of pride?
I think some did. I mean, it's very interesting. You have also the elites, the traditional elites that always congregate in a national capital that sort of run the civil service and everything else. You have this sort of intellectual and cultural economic elite that gathers there, and they would tended to be mixed, but many of those were liberally educated and viewed the Nazis quite askance, really. Viewed them, they were occasionally referred to as the Brown Plague. But then again, the Nazis were very good, in effect, at what they did, which was to sell a message to the German people and of course, from 1933, from when they came to power, they did an awful lot, actually, to make conditions for ordinary Germans an awful lot better and to raise Germany's status on the world stage. So, the sort of the dark underbelly of Nazi Germany wasn't immediately apparent to many Germans. So there was a very sort of a natural and sort of reflexive support for the Nazis for many years.
And they were certainly masters of propaganda used against
Absolutely.
Their own people. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that took place in Berlin that started to make people think, well, maybe this was something that we should get behind?
Well, I think the outbreak of war in 1939 is a massive turning point. My books are obviously, the title is Berlin at War, so it concentrates on that period, 39 to 45. The outbreak of war was something which I think shocked a lot of Germans, but especially in Berlin. It was, the memory of the First World War of 1914 to 18 loomed very, very large for all Germans, actually. The amount of Germans killed in World War I was something like 1.8 million. It was enormous, and the general sort of dislocation, the people died of starvation on the home front in Germany. It was a very, very traumatic event, and then of course you've got the aftermath in which Germany is sort of very publicly blamed for everything that happened, the outbreak of World War I. And in the aftermath you've got complete sort of political and economic collapse in Germany. So World War I looms very, very large. And when 1939 comes along, and in effect, I don't want to go through the entire sort of process of the outbreak of war, but in effect, war breaks out, in effect, by accident. Hitler was hoping to sort of saber-rattle and to threaten Poland into submission and didn't expect Poland to resist and then certainly didn't expect the British and the French to then declare war on him 3 days later. So in effect, he sort of blundered into the Second World War. He didn't expect it to happen in that way. And the reaction in Berlin is one of horror. Many people are absolutely sort of dumbstruck by this. And that, I think, is a sort of very profound turning point. and you look at these sort of mood reports, there's almost a graph that you can imagine about the you know the German mood in the capital, and it actually starts at a very low base in September 1939 because there is this real sense of foreboding that war has come again, you know, a generation after they'd finished the last one.
And they're dealing immediately with rationing.
Yes, rationing was brought in along with the blackout. Rationing was introduced right away at the very beginning of the war. Actually, the plans were set up a couple of days before the invasion of Poland, which is rather suspicious, as if the you know the regime sort of had an inkling of what was coming. So yes, they had the rationing system actually was relatively generous, certainly in what people were theoretically allowed or allocated. And then early in the war, it wasn't too bad. Later in the war, obviously, there was a gulf developed between what one was theoretically allocated and what one could actually get. So most people in the city that had the opportunity, which was the majority, would sort of top up their household from the black market and from, you know, selling whatever they could to whoever they could. So that, you know, in effect, the Nazis sort of ended up criminalizing vast swathes of German society by forcing them onto the black market. But at the beginning of the war, it was relatively generous, certainly more generous than, you know, the rationing was in Britain at the time.
And you mentioned the blackout. It's something that we don't have much experience with in the modern world, but this was very much a hardship for people.
It was. It is quite a peculiar concept, actually, I think, for the modern mind to get around. And we had the same, of course, in Britain at the same time. And the concept was, or the idea was basically that if your enemy bombers couldn't see a city, then they couldn't really bomb it at night. And, you know, most of the strategic bombing at that time was done at night. So the word went out that all lights had to be extinguished and nothing could be visible from 500 feet altitude. And the German blackout was very, very strictly enforced. All sources of light had to be, had to have a sort of colored shield or else be extinguished altogether. And it was enforced very, very rigidly. And if you were a persistent offender, you could end up in the concentration camp simply for not blacking out properly, which was quite astonishing. So the city really would have been absolutely pitch dark. And that, of course, had tremendous consequences for ordinary Berliners. You know, coming back from work, for example, in the winter months, you would be leaving work maybe at 5 o'clock. It would already be dark. And then, of course, you've got to make your way home across the city and into the suburbs in complete darkness, which was more than just a minor nuisance. And it could actually be deadly. I mean, it's quite bizarre. In those first couple of years, especially in winter, the numbers of people killed, whether in road accidents or sort of stumbling across railway tracks and being hit by trains, the numbers killed ordinary civilians is absolutely astonishing. And on average, it's sort of one a month I think it's probably more than that, but it's a very large number is killed on the railways and sort of stumbling off, you know, unlit sidings on the railways and so on. And large numbers were killed directly through the blackout.
And on top of all that, there was a serial killer on the loose.
Indeed, which is a wonderful, I can say a serial killer is a wonderful story, but I was actually very proud of that because it's something that I discovered in the archive. He'd been written about a little bit at the time, and subsequently in the 1950s had sort of briefly surfaced in one of the German news magazines, but then had been largely forgotten. And while I was researching into the area of crimes committed during the blackout, because there were quite a few, you know, quite a few high-profile murders and so on that were carried out under cover of darkness, and I kept coming across this name. And I sort of, ferreted a bit more into the archive and discovered this serial killer. And he was between August of 1940 and summer of 1941. He killed 8 women on German railways. He was actually an assistant signalman on Berlin railways, and he attacked women generally with an iron bar. And tended his modus operandi was to attack them and then throw them from a moving train. And of course, I mean, this sounds horrific, and I'm sure it was, But if that was happening these days, I'm sure, you know, our police forces would have it sorted out fairly quickly. But of course, if you bear in mind that there are, you know, fresh bodies almost every night on Berlin's railways, how do you sift which ones are murder from which ones are just accidents? So the blackout, in effect, sort of aided and abetted him at every turn.
What? So before the war, Berlin had been a sort of Jewish enclave, and people were relatively accepted by their neighbors. First of all, talk about, did that change? Did once liberal Berliners start to really resent the presence of Jews nearby? And clearly they were removed quickly. But can you talk about that?
It's a very complex scenario, actually, Chris, the whole thing, because you have different sort of different classes, if you like, or different sectors within Jewish society. There were large sections of German Jewish society in Berlin that were very well assimilated, that were as much German, if not more so, than they were Jewish, and saw themselves as utterly German. And then you had an influx from, you know, late 19th century and then the post-First World War years of what were known as Eastern Jews, Ostjuden, who tended to be unassimilated, often didn't speak terribly good German, and they were sort of, to many Germans, even to German Jews, assimilated German Jews, were seen as sort of something other, and something, you know, like Johnny Come Latelys that we could really do without. So there's a it's not just sort of Jews per se. There are also sort of differences even within the Jewish community. And again, the attitude of non-Jewish Berliners was also very different. There was a sort of a general reflexive anti-Semitism, which actually is a sort of a, you know, a pan-European phenomenon at the time. It's not something that's necessarily specific to Germany, certainly up until, you know, the early 30s. And that's something that the Nazis really do tap into and exaggerate and inflate. And it's obviously it's one of their sort of primary ideological goals is to foster anti-Semitism. But I mean, it's interesting that the Nazis come to power actually in spite of their anti-Semitism, I would say, not because of it, because although there's this culture of general anti-Semitism, it's not really something that's considered a vote winner, except on the you know, the wild extremes. So it's a very, very complex scenario that you're painting. You've got differences within the Jewish community itself and differences within, you know, non-Jewish community. So in Berlin itself, there's all sorts of, you know, all possible viewpoints are represented in a city like that. All the way from those that would have been quite sort of vehement, rabid anti-Semites, all the way to those that would, you know, happily, you know, help their Jewish neighbour in need and count them amongst their best friends. So every single attitude is represented, and I think this is in a way this part of the essence of the book is to try and understand Berlin sort of on its own merits. Try to get away from the stereotypes and try and see what Berliners themselves were saying. And in a sense, all human life is there. And that's kind of is the message of the book, that you know, you can't dismiss it as a society that's entirely sort of ideologized and marches in step. Some do, of course, but a large number of people actually don't. And in that sense, I think, you know, their society under Nazism is actually rather similar to our own. It's not that different.
Roger Morehouse is an expert in modern German history and author of the new book Berlin at War. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Roger Morehouse. He is a historian of modern Germany and also the author of the new book Berlin at War. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Roger, where were Berliners getting their information about the world around them during World War II?
Very good question, Chris. Again, it's one of those things that I think we have to put ourselves right back in their shoes to really appreciate. Your average Berliner, as you know, any German at the time, or indeed, I suppose, any Briton or any American, the primary source of information was the standard media, was radio and newspapers. And in Nazi Germany, both of those media were very, very strictly controlled. This was one of the, in a way, the genius of the Third Reich was their control of the media and their use of propaganda. And it wasn't the sort of blunt, clunking fist that you'd imagine it might have been. It was actually very, very subtle the way the media were controlled. And there was an awareness amongst the leadership, mostly, most importantly, Joseph Goebbels, who was the head of propaganda. There was an awareness that propaganda had to be subtle, in effect, to work. People had to not realize they were being preached to and being influenced in that way. Otherwise, they would switch off in their droves. So it's actually much more subtle than I think we generally imagine.
Would people have had access to BBC News over the radio?
Yes, I mean, that was another of those changes from the outbreak of war from September 1939 was that listening to foreign radio stations was banned and became, with a couple of, if you were caught a couple of times, it could even be a capital offence. Mm. So it certainly would land you in trouble and probably land you in a concentration camp at least. But yes, there are. You know, it's fairly anecdotal, but there seems to be evidence that large swathes of German society, right up, you know, almost to the top, actually, listened to the BBC, generally to hear another voice, to actually hear another viewpoint on things. Smaller numbers listened to, you know, the Soviet equivalent, which was the Soviet sort of. Provider of German language radio, which sort of kicked in 1941 after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, but it was very widespread, and it's been said that, you know, were it not outlawed, listening to foreign radio would have seemed the most normal thing in the world because in effect everyone was doing it. So yes, there was, you know, there was that side to it. There was another voice playing, but. Again, people, you know, you shouldn't necessarily imagine that just because someone tuned into BBC, it necessarily meant that they were sort of highly politicized or oppositional towards the regime. Many people weren't. They were just ordinary people that wanted to hear another voice, in effect, to hear the truth. You know, the longer the war went on, actually, for many ordinary Berliners, the less they believed in what they were told, and they wanted to hear another voice.
What were Aryan Germans told about the removal of Jews from their neighborhoods in Berlin?
Not very much, actually. It was very, very subtly done, and I think this is something we also have to understand the way the process in which the Jews were removed, were deported from Berlin and elsewhere, was done in a very, very subtle way. First of all of the Jewish sort of cultural and social organizations within the city were co-opted. To participate in the process, so all of the sort of the paperwork and the letters that went out and everything else regarding the deportation of Berlin Jews came from those Jewish organizations, and they were couched in very sort of soft language. So it didn't come from the Gestapo or the SS and say you must leave on this date. It said, you know, you'll come to this collection center, and your bags will be registered, and you will be loaded onto a train, and so on. The ultimate effect, of course, was the same, but it was couched in actually rather sort of gentle and reassuring terms. So for many ordinary Berliners, Aryan Berliners, they saw their neighbours being removed and, you know, disappearing to an unknown fate, and they knew as little, or perhaps even less, than the Jews being deported themselves. It's difficult. It's a difficult one to sort of to get your head around, you know, 60, 70 years on, to try and tell the story again. You have to try and put yourself in their shoes. And there were some who, you know, those that were more sort of anti-Semitic amongst Berliners who would have celebrated the removal of the Jews. And some of them celebrated that event sort of quite openly. But very many others who you know, regretted, you know, what appeared to be the next step in this sort of piecemeal persecution. But I think we shouldn't imagine that Berliners necessarily knew what was going on. I don't think they knew any more than the Jews themselves knew that they were going to their deaths.
So
there's a fundamental sort of imagination gap that the Holocaust, in effect, is unthinkable to most normal people.
Yeah. Does that explain, you think, that sort of soft sell, why more Aryan Berliners didn't stand up for their neighbors as opposed to fear of the Gestapo or fear of the SS or fear of persecution for trying to help? You know, today, knowing what happened, we all imagine that we would stand up for our neighbors. But
I think it's both. I think, you know, it's interesting, this aspect of, you know, fear of the Gestapo amongst ordinary Berliners. It's something that I think has sort of become a bit of a bogey in the last, you know, or certainly in the immediate post-war years. The Gestapo was built up as this sort of, you know, dreadful, all-seeing, you know, organization that kidnapped people and tortured them and did dreadful things. And of course, it did. We can't deny that. But it did it very subtly, and the vast majority of Germans would have felt, you know, perhaps a slight unease around a Gestapo man, but they certainly didn't see them as the sort of devils they've since become. And it's interesting that in post-war oral history studies, for example, there's the one done fairly recently, 2005, which concluded that 83% of Berliners recalled having no fear of a Gestapo during the war, which I think most modern readers would find astonishing. So it seems that if you were a normal German, you weren't oppositional, you didn't consort with Jews, you didn't consort with communists, you didn't oppose the regime, you actually had very little to fear from the Gestapo. They wouldn't bother you. But you knew they were there. And there was this sort of general concern, and people knew, you know, if you stepped out of line and you started to, you know, as I said, consort with Jews or consort with communists, then you laid yourself open to some difficult questions being asked. So there is that aspect. We shouldn't overplay the fear of the Gestapo. This wasn't a regime that was necessarily founded on terror, because it obviously wasn't.
I was surprised that there were fewer Gestapo agents operating in Berlin during the war than I would have imagined.
Yes, again, I mean, that's another one of my little discoveries in the archive, was that the you have to bear in mind that a lot of paperwork relating to the Gestapo was actually destroyed at the end of the war by the Gestapo itself. So the sort of archival record is often very fragmentary. And I found basically sort of internal memoranda in the archive, which had a rundown of sort of the numbers employed at different points through the war. And it's actually, for Berlin itself, for the Reich capital of the Third Reich, which is a city of 4.5 million people, there's never more than 1,000 Gestapo operatives working in that city. And the public mind would have told you that they must at least be in their tens of thousands, because they imagined Gestapo men to be listening to every phone call, eavesdropping on every conversation, and sort of hiding behind every tree. So the image of the Gestapo was one of omniscience, of all-seeing force. And the truth is actually something somewhat different, because it seems to be, it's mainly reactive. It tends to react to situations. It tends to react to denunciations from the public and various things like that. So I think we have to start to review our understanding of how the Gestapo actually worked.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First on the line, we'll speak with Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I thank you so much. I wanted to say to the author for what he's been talking about. I'm very fascinated with the Holocaust, of course. Almost an obsession. My question is, and comment is, that years ago I was at a photography exhibit of pictures, of course, from the Holocaust, and I noticed that there was one picture of African Americans. They looked like they must have been musicians or entertainers, and they were loaded up on a truck, and it looked like the truck had been taken away. And I know during that time period, like the late 30s, I would say even the mid to late 30s, that a lot of African Americans went to Berlin and they went to Paris to perform. And I just wanted to know if he had any comments about that, what happened to the black performers that were stuck there.
It's a very good question. It's a difficult question. It's a very good one. You're absolutely right. You know, there were Berlin certainly was, you know, very much a hotbed of jazz and the artistic avant-garde in the late 20s and early 30s, and as such became a very cosmopolitan city. And there were numbers of black Americans that lived in Germany. When the Nazis came to power, I think, you know, their first instinct was to try and sort of move these people on. And you know, with varying degrees of success, they'd try and sort of force them out and encourage them to go back whence they came. But there were a few that sort of refused or didn't leave. And generally, the German state didn't really quite know what to do with them. And certainly as the war outbreak of war, then it becomes much more difficult to actually sort of, you know, persuade people to emigrate and so on. And this is the problem the Jews faced as well. The Jews that remained in Germany, they actually couldn't emigrate after 1939. But the German state, you know, for all its sort of racist overtones, and it was racist in many, many ways, but it didn't really quite know what to do with you know, black Americans, African Americans. In some cases, in the extreme cases, they would be actually sterilized so that they, in effect, couldn't then, you know, reproduce, which was, you know, typical of this sort of racist view that the Nazis had. But as I said, they sort of, in a way, fell between various ideological stools for the Nazis. So in many cases, they were just sort of left to their own devices. And there's a very interesting memoir, the title of which I forget now off the top of my head, but I remember sort of citing it once for somebody else, which is about a chap. I think he lived in Hamburg in the north of Germany, and he must have survived the war to write the memoir. But spent most of the war in Hamburg and relatively unmolested. I don't think he was certainly sterilized, but he lived there and survived the war. So the Nazis didn't quite know what to do with you know, those African Americans and others that they found in their midst.
I want to talk about an extraordinary protest effort that I confess I had never heard of until I read your book, the Rosenstrasse incident. Can you tell us about what happened there?
That is actually a fascinating episode. I think it's becoming better known now. There's been a couple of books written about it, and there was a film made about it as well in the last few years. It happens in 1943, in February 1943, which is towards the end of that process of the Nazis, you know, deporting the Jews of Berlin. And one of the last operations of that process was called the Factory Action, the Fabrikaktion, February 43. And as part of that, there were a number of Jews of sort of, or Berlin Jews of usually the Jewish spouses of Aryan wives and husbands, who were sort of arrested in that particular action and were sent to a couple of holding centres, one of which was in this building in the Rosenstrasse. And as a result, their sort of Aryan spouses congregated on the street outside and sort of sang and protested and shouted for days on end, for about a week. You know, occasionally been sort of threatened by the SS and, you know, baton charges by the police and all sorts of things. But they stayed there and they sang and they smuggled food in and they protested until finally their loved ones were released. And it's a very peculiar episode. And actually, you know, the interpretation of it is actually key. I mean, it's a fantastic image, if you like. This is if we take it at face value, it's probably the only time that sort of people power stopped the Holocaust in its tracks, but it's not actually as simple as that. And there are two schools of thought historically as to what it actually signifies in the wider scheme of things. And that's something that I go into in the book. But it's certainly a fascinating event. And there are wonderful sources of people involved on both sides, you know, from memoirs and diaries and so on, from people who were inside the building and those who were outside as well, which I managed to use in retelling the story. It's a fascinating episode.
Can you talk for a minute about the use of the term Aryan? Obviously, this is troublesome for a lot of people, and in this conversation, we've been using it in the same way that the Nazis would have used it. Can you talk about what the word meant and what it means today?
it essentially meant, I suppose, not German non-Jewish. It was someone who was of, they in effect invented a sort of a larger national grouping, racial grouping, which incorporated Scandinavians, but also Germans, of course. So, and it was generally sort of thrown, the word Aryan would be thrown around as, in many ways, as a counterpoint to the word Jewish within Nazi Germany. So it was kind of an invented national grouping that was bandied around quite liberally. It's essentially meaningless to modern ears, because it's, you know, how you group nations like that together, I don't quite understand. But they managed to do it in a fairly spurious way, and it was an essential part of the German identity during World War II.
When was it decided that the children needed to be taken out of the city in large numbers for their protection?
That's the whole story of the evacuation from Berlin is absolutely fascinating, Chris, and that's I'm pleased you asked, actually. It starts, actually, when the British, as I said, in 1939, we weren't expected to go to war over Poland. It was all a bit of a nasty surprise for the Nazi leadership. And it was all the nastier a surprise when the British actually started bombing Berlin in the autumn of 1940. Initially, the sort of first raids, which were fairly, you know, we didn't really have the capacity or the airplanes to actually do too much damage. So the first efforts were sort of laughed off by the German regime, the Nazi regime. But within a few weeks, it got more serious, and soon there were sort of, civilian deaths on the ground, which was something that the regime had to react to. But they were also mindful that they didn't want to use the word evacuation. So they used this sort of very clumsy compound, which is, for those listeners that understand any German, the word is Kinderlandverschickung, which is the sending away of children to the countryside, if you translate it literally, which is known as the KLV, from Kinderlandverschickung. So they actually, you know, actively avoided the word evacuation.
Let me have you pause there, and we'll take a break and then get the rest of the story in just a minute. Roger Moorhouse is with us. He's an author and historian of modern Germany. His new book is called Berlin at War. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and historian Roger Moorhouse, whose new book is called Berlin at War. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So there's this massive effort, the KLV, to remove the children of Berlin and send them to the country, ostensibly for their own safety. Mm. It sounds like a lot of them did better in these really large sort of group homes than when they were placed with individual families.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I mean, it's sort of multifaceted aspect to it. But I think the main part of it, or the main thing to sort of bear in mind, is that the regime didn't sort of do this purely out of the goodness of its heart, if you like. It saw this as a massive opportunity to take that generation of children out of the clutches of their families and the clutches of their school teachers, who the Nazis were still often very dubious about. And to take them out and put them in these KLV camps, which were, like sort of scout camps, if you like, in many cases, or sort of holiday camps. And they would be there for maybe 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. And while they were there, they were under the auspices, generally, of the Hitler Youth. So, they generally take one school teacher with them to oversee things, but most of the daily routine and so on, and what was actually taught, which was generally very little in sort of educational terms, was done by the Hitler Youth. So it was sort of war gaming, and it was a lot of ideology and a lot of singing of songs and that sort of. So it's like sort of aggravated nationalistic scouts. Hmm. So it's a very, again, it's quite a subtle thing, but this was something that didn't get lost on their parents back home in Berlin. And this starts in the autumn of 1940. And, of course, they're removed from that that immediate threat of the bombing, which actually sort of fizzles out into 41. But then it comes back with a vengeance in 1943, and the bombing from 1943 to the end of the war was extremely severe. And then from the autumn of 1941, again, becomes compulsory to evacuate all children from the city. But it's interesting that Berliners, and elsewhere, actually, I mean, others in other cities, but I think Berlin particularly, they tended to try and resist the KLV, and the actual take-up of families using the KLV was actually relatively small. And there are many reasons for that. For many people, it was unideological. They just wanted to keep the family together in the hardship of the war. You didn't want to have your children, 200 miles away in the countryside while you're in the city. So people wanted to stay together and to face those difficulties together. But certainly for a minority of Berliners, they objected because they were very much aware of the regime's ulterior motive, which was to indoctrinate their children.
And that indoctrination was so complete that at one point the song Silent Night was rewritten to praise Hitler?
Yes, that's another one of the... I mean, this sort of thing, even at the time, I'm sure many Germans, and there's a couple that are, diarists and so on, that I quote, many Germans would have read that and just sort of rolled their eyes and thought, oh my dear, well, what have they thought of now? So this sort of, there was very much, like in the Soviet Union at the time with the cult of Stalin, there was a sort of a growing cult of the Führer and cult of Hitler during wartime. And this was one of those sort of, it's fairly preposterous, but this was a manifestation of that. And I don't think that would necessarily have been sort of sung around the campfires in the KLV camps. It might well have been. But, the indoctrination there often, especially in areas like in occupied Poland, where they often had those camps, they had them right across Germany and occupied Europe. But they often in Poland, they would go and sort of, pick a fight with the local Polish boys as a way of sort of not only toughening them up, but also as a way of, if you like, inculcating sort of, racist principles that we are better than those Poles. That was the idea they're trying to get across. So, the Silent Night was probably a little bit too subtle for the KLV camps.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I look forward to reading your book. I lived and worked in Berlin in the 90s after the wall came down. I loved Germany and the people. And by the time I was there, they'd removed most of the traces of the wall.
Yeah.
And what was left of the Russians, you could see really when they split the city, one of the things the Russians wanted to do was just to punish the Berliners, to make the Germans remember. It was just raw punishment, and propaganda. And I looked out from the Siegessäule, the victory column in the middle of town. I'm sure you've seen it. Most people have.
Yep.
You can see all this beauty and strength in the city, but then you feel this kind of ghostly darkness from the past, some of the things we've been talking about.
Certainly, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a city that doesn't really wear its history lightly. The history sort of, it does hang over a little bit, which I, as a historian, I find fascinating. I mean, when I was writing and researching the book, I would go, I live in the UK, but I would go over to Berlin sort of every couple of months for a couple of weeks to interview people and to work in the archive. And that time that I spent in Berlin, just I found absolutely inspirational, just because history is everywhere. It's on every street corner. And it's the same as what you're saying. You can see it as almost like a dark cloud, but I just, history is just absolutely everywhere in Berlin. And it is quite an astonishing city. But it's interesting, that sort of, about the, it's going off topic from what we're talking about this evening, but the Berlin Wall, and again, you look at the history of the 20th century, and all the way through, from World War One right the way up to 1989 when the wall fell, the center point of a lot of that, of most of that, is actually Berlin. It's quite astonishing. It's the cockpit of 20th century history. It's quite an astonishing place.
Well, let's go back to the very end of the war and talk about what happened when the Russians came in. This was a really horrific time for the people who had even lived through the bombings and the separations from family and everything else, those who were still in Berlin. The Russians did not treat them well.
No. It's very interesting. I mean, right at the beginning of the Nazi-Soviet war. So in the summer of 1941, there was actually very, you know, there was a speech made when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, a speech made by Molotov over the radio, where he informed the Soviet people of what was happening. And he was very careful to make this distinction between the Nazis and the Germans. You know, saying, in effect, that the Germans were good people who were under the rule of bad people. That distinction was fairly swiftly forgotten, obviously, with the, you know, with the hardship and the brutality and the slaughter on the Eastern Front, which was, of course, the, you know, the main theater of the war in Europe. So by the time that the Soviets or the Red Army gets to Berlin in 1945, there is no distinction whatsoever between Nazis and Germans, and everyone is viewed as, you know, the enemy, regardless of whether it's an old man or you know, an old woman or a six-year-old child. So there's really no quarter taken or given at all to the civilian population of Berlin. And added into that, of course, is that the city has been pounded from the air by the RAF and the US Army Air Force for most of the previous 2 years by that point. So it's the city is a sort of a, you know, in some places it's a complete moonscape of rubble. Most Berliners are, you know, certainly around the centre and so on, are living in their, in what's left of their cellars. And then, of course, you know, there's no power, there's no batteries for your radio, the telephone is out of order, there's no running water, there's no food. So by the time the Russians actually arrive, that April of 45, the city is already living, you know, in effect a sort of a troglodyte, almost Neanderthal existence. It's really on its last legs. So they, and when the Soviets come in, as I said, they take no quarter. They're absolutely often very, very brutal attitude towards the civilian population.
You quote one estimate here, 130,000 rapes?
Yeah. One of those phenomena that, I mean, this had already happened in the eastern, former eastern provinces of Germany, which the Soviets had already overrun, places like Königsberg. I think it's quite, you know, it's a common factor in warfare, in the most, you know, the most embittered warfare like that was, that, you know, civilian populations tend to be raped. It's a hideous fact, but this is a sort of a crude expression of power by incoming victorious soldiers, and that certainly was the case in Berlin. And it's something that the Russian and the Soviet authorities, and later the Russians, sort of tried to, didn't necessarily cover up, but they tried to sort of gloss over after the war, because it detracted obviously from the sort of their own image of the Red Army as a heroic sort of liberating force, which in many cases, of course, it was. But the dark side was that unfortunately, they tended to rape pretty much anything that moved in Berlin.
So at the same time, there were thousands of suicides among Berlin civilians.
Exactly. I mean, and again, that's, many cases it would be young women who couldn't live with what had happened to them. In many cases, it would be ideological, that you would have people who were fervent Nazis and believed in everything that the Third Reich had told them. And then they saw that all being destroyed before their eyes, and they felt that they couldn't go on, and they couldn't live in the post-Nazi world. So in many cases it was ideological, but in a vast majority of cases it wasn't. It was simply that, you know, they felt they couldn't go on.
How, I mean, it's really interesting that there have not been a lot of books that deal with German civilian life during this time in Berlin. Is that because you think of our discomfort with the idea that anyone who had any hand in supporting a regime like Nazism, just you can't even look at them with a sympathetic eye?
I think it's part of that. I mean, this is my book, I think, is a sort of a result of two trends in history writing and historiography. The first one is writing history from below. Mm-hmm. So rather than writing history about Hitler and about the generals and whoever it might be, but you understand what I mean by writing history from above. And there's been a growing trend, if you like, in the last 20, 30 years, which tends to try and reverse that and try and view history from below and look at what the average man in the street thought and what he was doing and what life was like for him. And the other point, the other trend is that is a slightly more sort of discomforting one, if you like. But after 1989, with the fall of the wall and the reunification of Germany, there has been a historiographical trend towards looking at, put simply, German victimhood. So prior to that point, the Germans only ever sort of, and they almost reveled in sort of telling the story of how awful they had been and the Holocaust and what horrors they'd inflicted on other people. And it was very much, you know, sort of very much mea culpa, the attitude was that we are to blame for all of these dreadful things. And then after 89, there's a gradual trend towards looking at those areas where Germans too suffered, you know, in the air war, for example, in which, you know, in Berlin alone, something like 60,000 people were killed, you know, by Allied bombing. And that is part of the story of World War II, and it's something that had traditionally been sort of overlooked and glossed over, and we don't really talk about that. And I think what I'm trying to do, certainly, is to bring that back into the narrative. It doesn't necessarily say that the Germans are saints, but it's saying that this is also part of the story, along with the Holocaust, along with all the horrors that the Germans and the Nazis perpetrated. There's also this other side to the story.
I'm curious, Roger, when you're going through journals and memoirs and diaries of people that may be long dead and who, because they're not famous people, you can't necessarily get an additional perspective. Mm. What sort of a critical eye do you have to apply to what they write, thinking that it's their private thoughts and recognizing that it may be their perception as opposed to concrete reality?
You're absolutely right. I mean, that is a, you know, a problem, and you have to be alive to it. It's all very sort of necessarily subjective, but in a way, you know, as historians, we are duty bound to be objective and to use objective sources. But then again, if you want to be picky about this, if you're reading sort of government documents, for example, those have been created and written down in many cases by one individual. Mm-hmm. So they're actually not that objective themselves. So I think this, we have to sort of take this with a pinch of salt. But in terms of my attitude towards the material I was reading, whether it's, you know, in a sort of, you know, a crumbling diary or whatever, I just tended to try and, you know, be alive to things that might have been unrealistic. And in most cases, I mean, what I found most interesting, actually, is how unideological most Berliners were. You know, these were not, in general, sort of fervent, goose-stepping Nazis.
They're just trying to get through the war.
Sorry?
Did they come across these people who were just trying to stay alive through this war?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They came across as people who were, you know, worried about their son at the front and worried about where the next meal was coming from, and worrying about their jobs, and worrying about putting food on the table, and very, very sort of everyday concerns that we all would share in that situation. And it, you know, there are a few, of course. There was one diary I found of a Gestapo man, which was quite, I mean, again, it was quite interesting. It was actually remarkably unideological. He doesn't really talk about ideology and the Nazi Party and so on at all. He talks about very sort of mundane things. But
Roger, I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Roger Moorhouse's new book is called Berlin at War. It's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.